Shakespeare wrote, "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers." Good morning. As I was introduced, my name is Bruce Stern. I'm a trial attorney. I've been a trial attorney for 25 years. I'm also the father of a 14-year-old and a 17-year-old daughter who's going to be a senior in high school like you are. That's why I didn't bring her with me this morning. What I'd like to do this morning is first talk about the civil justice system, something I've been involved in, as I said, for 25 years, talk about what my life as a trial attorney is about, and talk to you about how to handle, how I handle a case, a personal injury case, and how we go about getting it ready for trial, in some parts even trying the cases when that's required. The civil justice system is pretty simple. It's set up to hold those people who do harm responsible for the harm that they create. All of you are either just got your driver's license or going to get your driver's license, and you know, first you got to learn the rules of the road. Well, if you break the rules of the road and you hurt someone in an accident, then you're responsible for the harm that you cause. Pretty simple. You learned that when you come to a yield sign, you need to yield. If someone else has the right of way, you've got to yield the right of way. If you're going to make a left-hand turn, you have to let oncoming traffic pass you before you make that turn. But just like when we drive cars, there are rules for everything we do in this society. If you're a designer or manufacturer of a product, there's a rules you have to follow. Corporation that makes a product, designs a product, has to first identify what are the hazards, what are the dangers with that product. And having identified the dangers, the rule is that they then have to design out that defect. Now, sometimes you can't design out a dangerous component in a product. And when you cannot design it out, you have to guard against it. For instance, a lot of the manufacturers work on punch presses, where you take a piece of material and a press comes down and either punches a hole or flattens a piece of steel as a component to a product. Get your fingers in the way of that, and you're going to lose your fingers. And that used to happen all the time, until finally you had to stay started. They couldn't design it out, so they started guarding against it. Now, some things you can't design out, and some problems you can't guard against. In which case a manufacturer has a duty. The rule is you have to then warn the consumer of that problem. And when you don't design out or guard against or warn of, and someone gets injured, then that corporation is responsible for the harm that it causes. Same thing applies when you go to the doctor. There are certain rules that the doctors have to follow. Standard of care, accepted way you practice. And when a doctor breaks that rule or deviates from accepted standards and a patient is injured, then that physician is responsible for the harm that he or she causes. And that's the hallmark of our civil justice system. It has really two components to it. One is a deterrent to hold people responsible when they break the rules. And the other is to compensate, make whole the person that's injured. Two different sets of policy that goes into our civil justice system. Now, I started this presentation by quoting Shakespeare's "Let's kill all the lawyers." It's one of the most misquoted, statements or quotes that you'll hear. Everybody that wants to attack attorneys gives that quote. The truth was that that citation comes from Henry VI, where the anarchists are looking to overthrow the king. They want to have a coup d'etat. And so the anarchists get together and say, let's kill all the lawyers, because there cannot be the overthrow of the king, there cannot be anarchy until they kill all the lawyers. And Shakespeare had a great fear of the anarchists and may therefore wrote that statement. Today, the civil justice system is under attack. Starts with our president. President Bush, at every opportunity he gets, bashes trial lawyers. right after the election when he defeated Senator Kerry. He put together a group of people to look at the tort system. The tort system is synonymous with the civil justice system. So appealing to his large corporate political donors, he's assaulted the civil justice system. It was interesting when he put together this workshop of people, one of the participants was Robert Nardelli, who's the head of Home Depot. Not surprising, Mr. Nardelli had contributed $45,000 to the Republican Party. And was it just coincidence that Home Depot was sued in a class action by its workers claiming they were unfairly denied overtime and pension benefits? Like Alice in Wonderland and Queen of the Hearts, he only invited participants whose views coincided with his own. Kind of like off with their heads, the Queen shouted. Also present at the conference were supporters such as an obstetrician who alleged that she was forced to close her medical practice because of the high rate of medical malpractice insurance. Absent, however, was Linda McDougall. Linda McDougall was a woman from Minnesota who had a lump in one of her breasts and went in for a biopsy. The doctors mistakenly told her that she had breast cancer, and both her breasts were amputated. And only afterwards did they find out that the technician had misread the test results and she was free of cancer. Also absent from that conference were the thousands of patients who've been injured or killed as a result of medical negligence. 98,000 people a year in this country are killed as a result of medical negligence in hospitals. That's like an airplane crashing every day. When we have one plane go down, it makes the front pages. And yet, we're pretty silent, the newspapers are, with regard to the number of people maimed and killed in our hospitals. 2,500 infants are killed because doctors, nurses, and technicians don't wash their hands when in the hospital. Something we learn as young children. What's also interesting is in this assault by big business against the civil justice system is that there are more lawsuits filed by big business than there are by people like us who are injured in falls in motor vehicle collisions every year. We hear the big corporations talk about frivolous lawsuits, a term probably developed by Karl Rove and his band. And yet, according to the federal figures, 69% of big business is more likely sanctioned by federal judges for filing frivolous lawsuits than by individuals who bring personal injury actions. So why do we hear about attacks on the jury system? Well, one is because the only one that's going to hold big business accountable are trial lawyers. All of you are too young to remember the Ford Pinto. Back in the early 70s, Ford made a Pinto, and they made a Mustang at that time, which was really the same car with just a different body on its chassis. But Ford Pintos would explode if tapped in the rear because of a defective component on the gas tank. Just had to tap it in the rear at the right place, and that car would explode. Now, Ford knew that. Ford had done tests, and they knew that their cars would explode. But they also knew how much it would cost to replace that component. That component could have been fixed for about $1.25 per car. But when you added up all the cars that Ford made, all the Pintos they manufactured, all the Mustangs, all the Ford Colts, it was cheaper not to replace that component and pay whatever personal injury claims were made. However many people, because they could figure out how many people would be killed, how many people would be maimed, and what it would cost. And they did a cost-benefit analysis, and the analysis was it was cheaper to let people be killed and to pay their families than it was to replace this small component in their gas fuel system. Something you all may remember, not a few years ago, we had Firestone tires and Ford rollovers. Ford minivans have been rolling over for years. The Firestone tires, we've known, have been defective for years. But it wasn't until lawyers started bringing lawsuits against Firestone and Ford that those Firestone tires go off the market. That's the benefit. Cars today are safer than they have ever been before. And that's because of lawsuits brought by attorneys representing injured people and families whose loved ones have been killed. But big business objects. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce over the last few years has donated over $100 million in an effort to attack the civil justice system. Their president is Thomas Donahue, who has led a national campaign to limit people's rights in our civil justice system. He's attacked Elliot Spitzer. If you look at the New York Times, almost every day, Attorney General Spitzer is filing lawsuits, both civilly and criminally, against big insurance companies like AIG, going after Warren Buffett and reinsurance because of fraud committed. Is there any coincidence that the Bush administration and the Republican Party has protected big business at the same time the corporate executives are raiding their shareholders' pocketbooks? It's not coincidence at all. And so our civil justice system is under attack. I fought it every day when I was president of the state trial lawyers. I stood on the state house steps and accused the doctors of being mobsters. They went out on strike, leaving their patients unattended. Fortunately, in New Jersey, we were able to defeat that attack by the medical society. And just to kind of give you some type of, you know, frame of reference, there's no question that the insurance rates for doctors are too high in this country, that obstetricians are having trouble making ends meet. They are getting paid to deliver a baby $900, same amount of money they were reimbursed 15 years ago. It's what they're still getting 15 years later, and yet their insurance rates are going up. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that if your amount of money you're earning isn't rising and your insurance rates are, that your profit is going to go down. And so when the obstetricians began to complain about the high rates of medical malpractice insurance, our trial organization went to them and said, let's do something about your rates. Let's compel the insurance industry to raise what you get paid when you deliver a baby. But the Medical Society of New Jersey said no, because their attack was on the whole civil justice system. This, again, is a coincidence that lawyers donate money to Democrats, by and large, who don't represent big business. And so, again, there's a whole Karl Rove strategy to go after the lawyers, cut down the money we can donate in campaign financing. But enough of the campaign rhetoric, let me tell you what my job's all about as a trial lawyer. It's a grind, a lot of days. It's getting into the office at 7:30 in the morning and going home at 6:30, 7 o'clock at night. It's on the phone all day writing briefs. It's working Saturdays and it's working Sundays. But if you want to succeed, if you want to do well, that's what it's going to take. It's going to take hard work. Whether you're a lawyer or a doctor, anything you want to achieve in life, it takes hard work and dedication. Now, a case starts in my office when a client comes in to meet with me. He or she's been hurt in some way or another. Most of the time, I represent people who've had brain injuries. But I've represented people with back injuries that needed surgery, fractures, families whose loved ones are killed due to drunk drivers, where I've sued bars for serving people alcohol who are visibly intoxicated. They come in to see me. Most of these people don't have a lot of money. And in our civil justice system, the way lawyers get paid is what's called a contingency fee basis. That is, I get paid a percentage of whatever it is I recover for my clients. In New Jersey, that's about a third of whatever I recover. So if I settle a case for $1 million, my fee is going to be somewhere around $300,000 for representing that client. Sounds like a great deal of money. But I've represented that client for 5 or 6 years. I've probably spent $50,000 to $100,000 of my money or my firm's money to put that case together. And if I lose that case, I don't get paid. And then I've got to go back and tell my partners that I've just dropped $100,000 of their money. And if I'm a solo practitioner, I have to go home and tell my wife that I just lost $100,000 on that case. So when you hear about attacks on contingency fees, remember that people who were hurt couldn't bring that lawsuit. If they were to come into my office and I said, all right, I'm going to charge you $400 an hour, you're going to have to pay me a $25,000 retainer up front. I'm going to bill you off of that, and when I run through that, you're going to have to put up another $25,000. You're going to have to front yourself $50,000 or $100,000 in costs. How many of you or your parents could put up that kind of money to bring a lawsuit that you don't know whether you're going to win or you're going to lose? And that's one of the beauties of a contingency fee. And that's when the case starts. And what I do when a client comes in and I decided to take the case, because I've got to make that decision. Am I going to invest the time? Am I going to invest the money? Or I've got to tell the client I can't help them. I've got to look at the case and say, what are the chances of winning and how much money are we going to be able to get for that client or his or her family? And then we make the decision whether to accept the case or not. For the next 2 years, I pretty much just follow the clients. They go to doctors, they see neurosurgeons, they see orthopedic surgeons, they get operated on. We follow all that, and then we file suit. And then we start about 2 or 3 years of litigation where the fun starts. But the internet is such a wonderful tool these days. I mean, before we had it, you know, it was pretty hard to get information. Today, you sue a corporation, you go on the internet, you put their name in Google, and you can find out all kinds of things. We have to hire a lot of experts in our business. We hire accident reconstruction experts to figure out how sometimes a motor vehicle accident occurred. We hire orthopedic surgeons, we hire neurosurgeons, we hire neuropsychologists, psychiatrists, I hire vocational experts to testify whether or not my client can ever go back to work. Maybe she can go back to work but can't do the same type of work. I hire people to figure out how much medical care my clients are going to need for the rest of their lives. The defense does the same thing. The people defending the case, they hire experts. And then we get into depositions where we get to question those experts. Again, then with the internet, you can find out a great deal of stuff. I'm involved in a case now, a young boy over at the Petty School. His parents were back for alumni day. One of the workmen was backing up a food truck to pick up, deliver some food, ran over the little one-year-old boy, crushing his skull. He fortunately survived but has damage to his brain. And so the defense hired a pediatric neurologist from Robert Wood Johnson, who said that all my client's problems that he has now weren't from having his skull crushed by this truck, but was pre-existing because the child was slow in speaking. I went on the internet and found out some wonderful things, this expert had written in the past, totally contradicted what he had written in the report. So I can't wait till September when I get to cross-examine that expert and confront him with what he'd written years ago. But we try cases today so much different than we used to try them. When we used to begin trying cases, we came up with a big theme. I remember representing a 19-year-old young man from Trenton who borrowed a car that wasn't his in the city of Trenton and took it for a ride through Trenton, through Lawrence, into Ewing Township, being chased by Trenton's finest, Lawrence's finest, Ewing's finest, ultimately ending up in Pennington where he rolled the car over, jumped out, was trying to escape, and was shot down by one of the Ewing Township police officers. being one of the new attorneys in the office, they gave that case to me to try. So I was representing this young boy who had stolen this vehicle, but had been shot down and shouldn't have been shot by a Ewing police officer. So I remember going up, the judge said to me, "Mr. Stern, it's give your opening statement." So I went up to the board and I wrote police brutality. I thought that was a quaint way to start. And then talked about my poor client had been shot down by the police. So we used to come up with things like, this is a case about profit and safety. Today we don't try cases like that anymore. We don't focus on our clients. The insurance industry has done a fabulous job of getting the public to believe there are too many frivolous lawsuits and that it's a lottery when we go to court. All of you that watch are Big 24 fans. You see all the Allstate commercials with the actor who played the president in 24 talking about auto insurance fraud. It's not a commercial about Allstate. It's a commercial to get all of you to believe and everybody else to believe that people that bring lawsuits are committing fraud. And it's a commercial to keep jury verdicts down, disguised poorly as a commercial to get you to buy Allstate insurance. So today we try cases differently. We focus more on the defendant. I'll give you an example of how you can present a case differently. Let me tell you a story about Jacob Smith. Jacob Smith was a CPA. He was an accountant. Very precise individual. Every morning he would get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. He would have breakfast, he would shower, change, and leave the house precisely at 7 o'clock. Drive 30 minutes to his office and start working from 7:30 to 12 o'clock. 12 o'clock, no matter what he was doing, no matter what he was involved in, he would stop working. And he would go to lunch for precisely 1 hour. 1 o'clock, he would come back and work until 5 o'clock, leave his office, go home and have dinner. Every night by 10 o'clock, he was in bed. The only difference would be if it was in the summer. On Friday afternoons, he would leave around 3 o'clock to meet his family at their shore home on Long Beach Island. Every day, every Friday, he would leave at 3:30 to go down the shore. Well, one July Friday, it was a beautiful day out. And he decided, you know, my kids always tell me to chillax. And he decided, you know, I'm going to leave around noon, go down the shore, surprise my wife and kids. Gets in his car and driving down through the pines to Long Beach Island. And as he crossed, when he got into the intersection with Route 70, a drunk driver came through, broadsided him, killed him. At his funeral, one of the mourners was heard to say, "If only." If only. If only what? If only he had waited till 3:30 like he used to. If only he hadn't gone to the shore that day. If only what? Most of you could think in your mind, if only what? But how many of you are thinking, well, if only that other driver hadn't been drunk? Well, because I told the story to you from the perspective of the person who was killed, your natural thought is to blame him. If only he didn't do something. Not many of you thought, well, if only the other driver hadn't been drunk. And so we try cases so differently today. Today we focus on the defendants, where we used to focus on the family who was injured, the individual who was injured. So if I was going to tell you that story differently, I would tell you about a 22-year-old boy who went to the bar at 10:30 in the morning, kept throwing them back until about 1:30, could barely stand up as he left the bar, got in his car, drove down Route 70, ran the red light, and killed a driver in another vehicle. Or if I was suing the bar that served him, I might tell you the story from the perspective of the bartender who saw this 22-year-old come in, already half-lit, served him drink after drink, watched this 22-year-old get up, stagger to the bathroom, come back and ask for another drink and put another one up on the bar. And so then if I said to you, if only, we'd hear different if onlys. If only the bartender hadn't served him, if only he hadn't been drinking. Same story, but the only ifs all change depending on the perspective of the story that's told. Now my daughter would tell you, or tell me, that, well, it really depends on how good the lawyer is. After Michael Jackson beat the charges out in California, she said to me it wasn't fair because he had a good lawyer. After OJ beat the charges out in California, she told me it wasn't fair because he had a good lawyer. And that's a lecture in the criminal justice system. And I always say to her, it's not that wealthy people can afford good lawyers. The problem is we don't supply good lawyers to poor people, because everybody should have access to the same lawyers. But that's one of the nice things in our civil justice system, is that whether you're rich or poor, you can hire the same lawyer. You don't have to have a nickel to your name, and you can hire me just like the wealthiest person can come in to my office and hire me to represent them, because I'm only going to get paid on whether I succeed or not. But most cases don't get tried to at all. I've been doing this 25 years. I love being in the courtroom. I love trying cases. Win cases, you lose cases. They're still fun. They're still extremely stressful. I've never gotten used to taking a verdict. When, you know, you're trying cases, that's fun. You're on your feet. You're cross-examining experts. You spent hours and hours of time getting ready for that cross-examination. I always feel like a tiger in a cage just waiting to get let out to go rip somebody up when I'm going to cross-examine them. Because I know as much as they do on whatever the topic is. I've taken their depositions. I've researched their writings. I've gotten transcripts of other cases in which they've testified. It's a lot of fun. But when that jury goes out to deliberate, there's nothing else I can do. That was one of the interesting things when they were interviewing Michael's criminal trial attorney. They asked him what he thought about when the jury went out, and he said he thought that the jury was going to come back with acquittals, that the evidence had gone in pretty well. Unfortunately, all we get to see is CNN or Court TV and people that never tried cases telling us what's going on in that courtroom when only the jurors were sitting there. Now, I will tell you this about jurors. You know, they get attacked. You hear them, see movies, John Grisham's runaway verdict. But I believe the jurors and juries try to do the right thing. And they not always get it right. There may occasionally be an outlandish high verdict. Oftentimes there's going to be a no cause. The plaintiff's going to lose when the plaintiff should have won. We always say a good trial lawyer is one who's won the case he should have lost and lost the case he should have won. But for the most part, jurors do try to get it right. They do struggle. They don't go in there and say, you know, how I'm just going to give away the farm because we don't like the defendant. If they give away the farm, there's a reason the farm was given away. And usually the conduct by the defendant was outrageous. Most of you have heard the story about McDonald's. It's one of the ones that tort reformers love to talk about. You know, a lady goes and orders a cup of coffee, spills it on herself, and then wraps McDonald's for $4 million. What they don't ever tell you is really the real facts of that case. There's a woman who went to McDonald's and ordered coffee. But McDonald's heats their coffee hotter than anybody else heats their coffee. People had been burned by McDonald's coffee for years. They knew it. The industry, the rule that I started about was that the temperature of coffee when it leaves the takeout window was supposed to be a lot less. McDonald's knew that. And they chose to have this coffee be really hot. They gave her the coffee. They gave her sugar and milk. Where was she supposed to put the sugar and milk in the car? And it burned her. But before they went to the trial, they sat in the judge's chambers. And that judge recommended that McDonald's pay a couple $100,000 to settle the case. McDonald's said no. And the verdict came in. And what they don't tell you is ultimately the judge reduced that verdict down to about $400,000. And so when you see in the paper these huge, huge verdicts that sometimes you see, what you don't follow is what happens with those verdicts. As it might be nice to go, I tried a case last year for a young boy who suffered a brain injury when the defendant ran a red light out on Route 1 here in Lawrence. I got a $1.8 million verdict. Defendant only had $100,000 of insurance. So all I collected was $100,000 for that individual. Papers said we won $1.8 million, but all we collected was $100,000 because that's all the insurance that there was. And so sometimes that happens. But it's a good system. And I recommend to you, despite what I said to you about it being hard work and being a grind sometimes, I recommend going into law for all of you. Even if you decide not to be a trial lawyer. Because trial lawyers only make up a small portion. You can go into banking law, you can go into environmental law, you can go into criminal law, go into litigation that's not personal injury, go into corporate transactional work, you can draft wills. Wonderful, wonderful opportunities. If you just want to go into business, having a law degree will never hurt you. Anything in life you want to do, having a law degree will only help you. Want to be a stockbroker, get a law degree first. So those are the kind of prepared remarks. I have my computer here. I was hoping to be able to show you some of the cases I've worked on, some of the exhibits that I've showed. Unfortunately, we're technologically challenged in this building, despite the fact that the computer room is next door. So unfortunately, I can't show that to you. So in the 10 or 15 minutes that we have left, I'm happy to take any questions that some of you may have.